What's up, sports fans? What's up, gamers? Welcome once again to the Two Line Offside podcast, the podcast where it doesn't matter if you're onside or offside, just as long as you're inside the lines. If today's the first time you found this podcast, I'm so glad you're here. If you're a recurring listener, then thanks a thousand times for coming back. But, just like I have done for every FIFA episode throughout this, I'm going to suggest that if this is the first time you're listening, or maybe if this is the first time you've listened to me in a long time, sorry for the delay, then you should go back and listen to all the FIFA episodes in order from 1 up until now in order for that to make sense. The story makes a lot more sense if you listen to it in order. Now that we've gotten that out of the way, and hopefully our new friends, and maybe even some of our old friends who've been waiting patient for me to get this episode done, are all caught up. Let's get going on episode 6 of our FIFA series, a series even I'm hoping will be finished with either one or two more episodes after this one. Another thing that I've also done for nearly every episode so far is given one of you one of these fancy disclaimers. Just so you know, when I get excited about sports or games on this podcast, I've been known to swear. That said, I wanted both you, your grandma, my grandma, and even your very conservative cousin to be able to listen to this podcast without fear of swear words. But when it comes to beeping, we do things a little bit differently. Rather than using this sound, I'm going to pick two random sounds that somehow relate to the theme of this episode. Your job is to try to guess in the comments to see if you can figure out how these two sounds are somehow related to the episode. If you want to find out the answer, you can find that in the middle intermission section of the next episode, which I mark with two whistle sounds like this. Now, before we get started, just one more disclaimer. I'm going to be talking a lot in this episode about some legal mumble-jumble as it relates to FIFA. But I want you to also know that I am 100% not a lawyer. In fact, I literally took one law class in high school and one law class in university. Basically, what I'm saying is that if you're trying to get your legal advice from a sports and games podcast, then you're totally doing it wrong, and I won't be held responsible if you do so. So, in true Two Line Offside fashion, I'd love to dedicate this episode to my good friend Julia, who, along with some of her law school friends, just graduated law school as of the recording of this podcast. Congratulations, guys. I can't wait to see what you go on and do next. Lastly, let's give you somewhat of a little recap. So the last time I left you with a little bit more of the history of soccer in the good old US of A. Though it might have seemed unclear to you as to why we shifted so drastically from talking about Qatar to the United States of America, it'll all make sense in the fullness of time. I promise. All right, now it's finally time to write what I think will be one of my favorite episodes to date. This time, let's really do it. Let's go offside. So here's a bit of a brain twister for you. What do you get when you combine a football fan with an IRS, short for Internal Revenue Services agent, with an eye for the details who once worked for organized crime? You get a guy who's the star of the pod today, IRS agent Steve Berryman. I bet you're wondering how we got from talking about the silly acronyms FIFA uses for its block organizations to talking about the big man government tax guys. Well, slow your roll, offsiders. I got you. In line with our new favorite source for all things FIFA, the book Red Card by Ken Binsinger, a book you should, again, totally read if you like this podcast, I'm going to introduce you to our newest dynamic duo, the first of which is IRS agent Steve Berryman. The second of these is Steve's later-to-be partner, in this case, FBI agent Jared Randall, but more on him later. Unlike Ken Binsinger in his book Red Card, though, I'm not only going to let you in on the fact that he's self-described in Red Card as a, quote, tax man with a gun, because the hero of the FBI's largest takedown in history as of late, and how he became the hero of the FBI's largest takedown in history, but I'm also going to give you a little bit of a crash course into how the system our Americans friend call the United States intelligence community actually works. That, and I'm going to teach you a little bit about the American legal system. But back to the main character of this particular pod, our guy Steve Berryman. Back in 2011, when Ken Bensinger starts his book, Steve Berryman was a 47-year-old tax IRS agent who grew up an Air Force Army brat on various U.S. Air Force bases in England. Likely as a result of his time in England, Steve became a lifelong football fan, long after his family moved back to the United States. And, just like some other notable soccer-turned-American football kickers, like Dallas Cowboys kicker Brandon Aubrey and Josh Lambeau of the San Diego Chargers, who honestly probably deserve their own episodes, a young Steve Berryman took the kicking skills he learned from classic football in England and steered them into a fairly successful career as a place kicker in American football. Good enough to get him a scholarship, which would land him first at Eastern Illinois University before he transferred to Cal State at San Bernardino, where he finished his degree in accounting. How does somebody from FIFA get themselves into serious actual federal trouble with the US government taxman, though? As always, I'm so glad you asked, because there's nothing I love more than a good old-fashioned deep dive on this podcast. Usually I like to start the story in a way which is slightly different from that of my source, you know, in the spirit of not plagiarizing things, or just basic journalistic integrity. That said, our guy Ken Bensinger, who wrote the book Red Card, did such a good job taking us through the events of how IRS agent Steve Berryman found the FIFA corruption case on his desk, that I'm going to borrow from his timeline. So you remember that time you posted pictures of yourself and your friends having a blast on a Saturday night out, and then your mom sees them and asks why you weren't out at the library? Yeah, we've all been there. The trappings of the social internet are many. Turns out, though, that it's not just university students on a Saturday who can fall victim to this. Steve Berryman found out about FIFA being investigated by the FBI the same way a lot of us might remember something as simple as our friend's birthday. Steve Berryman had set up Google alerts for keywords such as money laundering, corruption, Bank Securities Act, and the Foreign Corruption Policies Act, according to Ken Bensinger's book Red Card. To understand how we get all the way to the end of this story, let's rewind a bit. And look at the very article that started things for Mr. Berryman on his journey. The article in question, which was written by Mark Hosenball from Rutgers in August of 2011, payments over $500,000 made to U.S. Exco members, and Episode 3 darling Chuck Blazer. This possibility being discovered shortly after Chuck himself had blown the whistle on corruption in FIFA on his boss at CONCACAF, Jack Warner. This corruption leak had made its way to the FBI at the hands of the well-known and infamous British journalist Andrew Jennings. What lesson can we take from this? Well, turns out that not only can high-ranking government officials set Google alerts, they can also read the news and blog posts. Shocking, I know. All right, now that we know the honestly pretty uncomplicated way that the FBI has found its way to FIFA, let's get back to the story of our main character of today's episode, Steve Berryman, aka IRX Tax Guy. Ken Bensinger has done an incredible job of explaining, at least in part, who Steve Berryman is as a person and as an IRS agent. You should totally go read his book, which he's not paying me to say, but in the interest of not completely plagiarizing his book, I'm going to explain Steve Berryman by comparing him to one of my friends, Peggy. This friend of mine is so incredibly invested in music and specifically music history, that it's honestly kind of baffling to me. She gets so jacked up about the, quote, incredibly important intricacies of Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton, or can come up with incredibly intelligent answers as to why it is that Bach uses a specific harmony pattern in Concerto No. 7 or whatever. Basically, what I'm saying is that not only is she incredibly smart when it comes to music, she also gets passionately excited about stuff that your average person wouldn't give a second look at. What this gives us is someone who sees beauty in the mundane and is highly driven at her chosen skill. This is how I imagine Agent Steve Berryman. Upon reading the article in Rutgers, just as I had described to you, Agent Berryman not only immediately sent the article to his supervisor, he then ran to her office to make sure she had read the email. What's more powerful than an IRS agent who loves to follow the money and chase folks cheating the American tax system? A dude like that who loves football. What better way to show the world just how much you love the beautiful game than by cleaning up its slimy criminal underbelly? I don't know about you, but even I'm excited about this numerically sports-tinted crime drama. So let's fucking go, kids! Let's follow the numbers. Okay, so if it wasn't abundantly clear by that sound effect that I so lovingly made for you, this is about to be the very nerdy part of the podcast where I'm going to take you into the weeds of the American tax system. For those of you who are perhaps, rightfully so, puking at the prospect of learning about tax law in America, don't worry. I'm going to sprinkle it a little bit. While teaching you about that, I'm also going to find a way to integrate some of how America's spy agencies work. That's slightly more interesting now, isn't it? Now, if there's one thing that one political science class I took in school once taught me, it's that America likes to stick its nose in other countries' business. That I learned this, I of course knew that America likes to assert itself. It didn't occur to me until I read Ken Bensinger's mind-boggling book itself, the way that America has a pretty large reach outside of itself when it comes to taxes. Though it's only through a few classes for me, among just a basic grasping news, or monies that pass between nations, which would otherwise seem to have nothing to do with the United States. First off, and I promise this seemingly small fact is relevant in the grand scheme of things, of the hammer that we're about to bring down on FIFA. So America is among other nations, although Ken Bensinger incorrectly states in his book that it's only Atreya that counts itself among this. America is one of several nations where, as an American citizen, even if you're living outside of America, anywhere in the world, you must still file American income tax, thanks in part to a recent norm-breaking, slightly orange-tinted U.S. president. You may or may not be aware that it's actually really to act on or even look at another person's income tax, despite the fact that it may be tradition for the incoming U.S. president to make his, or hopefully one day her, income tax statements public and for the American public. American law is pretty strong on this idea of income tax privacy. In fact, it can even be exceptionally difficult for the government itself to see these documents for its own citizens. Nerd alert, 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 incoming nerd alert, alert. Nerd alert, alert, incoming nerd alert, alert. Now, as if that very cool, very nerdy sound effect was not enough of a warning, I'm about to take you down a little bit of a legal rabbit hole that might even impress some of those friends of mine who went to law school instead of starting a sports podcast. Did I totally look up the actual section of U.S. tax code that it's supposed to make it hard for even the government to look at your income tax for any reason? You bet I did. But turns out, stuff like this takes a lot more reading than I'm willing to put into a single section of this podcast. Turns out we might actually pay lawyers to read really boring stuff. What I was able to find is, surprise, surprise, the section of the U.S. Constitution that relates to this. Americans love that thing. So let's read of a piece of it before a slightly scary impending election causes some folks to start questioning it, shall we? Then I promise we'll learn some super cool spy stuff. So, the 16th Amendment goes like this, quote, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, quote, to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the general welfare of the United States, but all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform, close quote. Basically, what that means in English is that Congress has granted the right to your tax income in the United States to basically run the country and collect the census. Because for a reason that honestly still baffles me today, they thought that knowing a bunch of random stuff about their citizens was really important. What? The government of the United States wants to know random shit about its people? But Mal, isn't that technically spying? That, my friends, is what we call a segue. Time for some spy stuff. Oh shoot, folks. I'm gonna have to leave you on a bit of a cliffhanger for that one. Just a little bit longer, because I think I hear a whistle. Just kidding, I totally hear a whistle, because I'm the one who put it there. In case you're a real rebel and you're listening to this pod for the first time, this is how intermission's gonna work. This is the part of the pod where I throw some of the random facts that I found while researching this episode. Couldn't find a good place to put them. Now, if you want to be a total knuckle-dragger, I'm also going to give you a timestamp so you can skip this section. Though, I think the stuff I've drummed up is pretty cool this time around. If you want to skip right to the rest of the story of Steve Berryman and the FBI going for FIFA, you can go to here.
24:35.
Nothing I talk about in intermission will be important for the rest of the main story. All that said, let's go, shall we? It's time for intermission. In case that I haven't made it clear by introducing to you to IRS tax agent at an IRS tax agent at the beginning of the pod, some of the big boys in FIFA are about to have problems with the tax man. Turns out, though, it isn't just wealthy FIFA Exco members who don't like to pay their taxes. I thought I might like to spend some intermission introducing you to some of the famous faces who don't like the idea of paying taxes to the government. I'm pretty sure I talked about this guy in the last podcast, and again, I'm pretty sure podcast logic would tell me that it would be best to leave this guy for last, but I'm far too impatient for that. Al Capone is known as quite possibly one of America's most notorious gangsters. Before that, though, Al Capone was born on January 17th, 1899, to two Italian immigrants in Brooklyn, New York, Gabrielle and Teresa Capone. Unlike a lot of the gangsters of his time, Al didn't grow up in poverty. His parents had fairly middle-class jobs for the time. The area they were living in was the harder area for one to live in, though. This, combined with what I can only describe as a chance meeting between a then 14-year-old Al Capone and an actual gangster, happened in Brooklyn. Johnny Torrejo. Thanks to the mentoring of Johnny Torrejo, who taught young Al how to do something that we're going to get really familiar with soon, Johnny Torrejo taught Al Capone how to money launder. For those of you who have not spent a considerable amount of time learning how this man works, let me explain. So let's say you're a criminal, and you're selling drugs. Assuming you're even remotely successful at this, you're gonna end up with a bunch of extra cash. Now, you could take all of this dough and buy yourself a Lamborghini, but if your regular job pays you something that's close to minimum wage, you're probably gonna raise some suspicion with your new Lambo. How do you solve this problem by hiding your extra illegal drug cash? You launder it. Let's pretend to do this, you start a laundromat. You take the cash that you've earned illegally through selling drugs, and then use it to fund, say, your laundromat. Now that money that you've earned through drugs looks like it's been earned and used on your laundromat. It looks like it's been earned and used legally. That is how money laundering works, and a young Al Capone became a master at this practice. Except for Al Capone, the money was not in selling fentanyl or meth, but in prohibition alcohol in Chicago. Al Capone also made money by running brothels, prostitution, and gambling organizations in Chicago. He basically took over gang organizations for his mentor Johnny Torrejo. The story of Al Capone and how he managed to avoid prosecution for his crimes, in part by running for local office and intimidating and even kidnapping voters, is fascinating. But just as I stated earlier, it's something fairly boring that brought him down. In May 1927, as stated by the fine folks at biography.com, the Supreme Court of the United States decided that people who were making money off bootlegging operations were also subject to paying income tax on their income. He was initially arrested in May of 1929 in Philadelphia for carrying a concealed weapon. Ironically, he was let out of jail in March of 1930 for good behavior. That didn't stop, however, the federal government, from chasing Capone for evading taxes on his bootlegging operations. Just a year after his release, government officials managed to expose Capone's prohibition operation, as well as indict him for the tax evasion they'd been chasing him for. On March 13th, 1913, the federal government indicted Capone with 22 counts of tax evasion, worth over $200,000. This also led to the charging of 68 members of his gang for similar violations. Being convicted for his tax crimes by an earlier version of the same IRS you and I are talking about, Al Capone was sent to the now infamous Alcatraz prison. He died on January 15th, 1947. Number 2. Pete Rose. Perhaps more well-known for being expelled from Major League Baseball for betting on his own team, the Cincinnati Reds, while he was still a manager, though Rose was never actually charged for a crime for these transgressions, he was banned from the MLB for life. His transgressions as it comes to gambling were exposed in a report known as the Dowd Report in August 1989. What he's less well-known for, however, is what he did after his banishment from baseball in order to keep himself afloat. In 1990, just a year after signing the document which not only banished Rose from Major League Baseball, but also banished him from the chance of being inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame, he went to federal prison. Rose served 5 months in federal prison for tax evasion. Rose, as it turned out, was making large sums of money from signing memorabilia and going to baseball shows without paying taxes on that income. He may be well known for his betting transgressions, but the man known during his time, the time of his career as the Hitting King, was also not above simple tax evasion. That particular piece of information comes to us courtesy of the folks at Fox Sports. Now comes the part of the pod I'm sure you've all been waiting for if you're listening to the intermission. It's the part of the pod where I tell you what sounds I used as censorship for our last episode. So the first sound I used was the sound of a falcon, which is a pretty important animal for the richer people of Qatar, who fly and keep falcons as pets. The second sound was the sound I used to play on the title Desert Heat 2. That, my friends, was the sound of a windy desert. Now that you're all caught up on the sounds from last episode, you guys ready to hear how we bust some more FIFA guys in the most nerdy way possible? Because I'm here to tell you. Are you ready? Let's do it. Let's go offside. Remember a little earlier when I told you I'd spice up a bunch of that constitutional American legal mumbo-jumbo by telling you a little bit more about American intelligence system and how it works? Well, we finally made it to that part. Luckily for you guys, I didn't have to work too hard to know how. It's part of how the IRS and the FBI share information with each other, and it's relevant because and open to us thanks to the folks at the LA Times who did that for me. According to an article written by Nina Argwal, hopefully I said that right, in January of 2017, There are 17 offices that exist as part of the United States Intelligence Agency as we know it today. At least 17 offices that we know about. Let me break it down for you as it relates to our episode. Number 1. Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Like the title might suggest, the Director of National Intelligence is the head of the Intelligence Committee, who reports directly to the President with issues related not only to national security, but he also coordinates important spies in America. This is the top guy in American spying. Number 2. Federal Bureau of Investigations. So I likely don't have to tell you who these guys are, but just in case, I will. The FBI is both a legal and intelligence-gathering arm of the U.S. government, according to Nina Argwell of LA Times. They defend the United States against a multitude of threats, both foreign and domestic. And, yes, the FBI is also the organization that frequently stars in many of Dick Wolf's shows, busting various criminals. If the government had an arm of police like officers, this would be it. They're also known to clash with the CIA, but that's for another day, and honestly, probably a different podcast entirely. Department number 3. Department of the Treasury Office of Intelligence and Analysis. This is the part of the pod where I gain a little bit of street cred with my musical friends. This is the branch of the government which contains the IRS. The IRS being the organization in the United States which was started by America's favorite rapping Treasury Secretary and Lin-Manuel Miranda's favorite, Alexander Hamilton. Anyway, the IRS is a branch of the government which is housed within the Department of Treasury. Again, according to the reporting of LA Times writer Nina Argwell, the Office of the Treasury, quote, sits itself within the Office of Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, which works to prevent sanctioned countries, money launderers, terrorists, drug kingpins, and purveyors of weapons of mass destruction from parking or moving their money through the U.S. legal system. But, Mel, you're asking, what on earth does the FBI, existing within the same tree of intelligence as the IRS, have to do with anything? Again, I love it when you guys ask me questions like this. So, like I said earlier, because of how U.S. privacy and tax law works, it can be very hard even for an agency like the FBI to get hands on a person's or organization's taxes. You can only imagine that rich guys and folks that hold many offshore bank accounts make this job even harder. Having the IRS and FBI be sister organizations in the United States intelligence makes this still not super easy, but a little bit less taxing. That brings me to the very long-awaited introduction to one of the final characters of this story. With a little help from one of his friends in the FBI, because, according to Ken Binsinger, there's no way for IRS agents to actually access FBI case files, Steve Berryman was able to get in contact with Jared Randall, who was the head FBI agent on the FIFA case that had brought initial charges against FIFA. Now, as I'm typing this, I realize I didn't do a very good job of explaining why the FBI was bugging on FIFA in the first place. So let's do that first. Through the magic of podcast editing, let's rewind a bit. That's a little better. Welcome to August of 2011. This is the time that the FBI's initial case against FIFA's top official became public knowledge. It became public knowledge because on that day, the FBI stated that they were looking into what they believed was a $500,000 worth of bribes that went through U.S. banks as it related to FIFA elections and or World Cup bids. I admittedly would rather not rattle off about this particular incident, but what I will say is it's not the only time that arrests will happen, even in this particular episode. This, my friends, is another instance of foreshadowing. Turns out the FBI cares about corruption here and even among folks who have very little to do with America itself, other than through some legal red tape. What do corruption charges actually mean? Again, time for me to put on my very amateur legal hat and give you yet another legal definition for what corruption charges in the US legal system actually mean. Again, according to the fine folks at the Cornell Law School and their Open Legal Dictionary, corruption is, quote, the dishonest, fraudulent, or even criminal act of an individual organization using entrusted authority or power to make personal gain for unethical or illegal benefits. Corruption happens not only in political fields, but also in social and economic fields such as business, education, media, and in our case, sports. A lack of transparency and effective regulations are often the main cause of corruption, close quote. Does this mean that I actually know what those specific illegal acts that caused those FIFA officials to be charged were in August of 2011? Nope. As I'm sure you can guess, even though these cases are well and truly old, the FBI is pretty secretive about this stuff, even well after it's over. But, again, now that our guy Steve Berryman has seen this go down at the IRS, he wants in and to take a look at the case as a football fan with a passion for chasing the bad guys by following the money. And, like I said, this is not the end of arrests in this episode. Though, like I've said before, this massive hammer that the FBI and the IRS are about to bring down on FIFA is gonna take some serious legwork. And because it's the government, it's gonna take some serious time. We don't have to wait that long, though. So, let's use some of that podcast magic and fast forward back to where we were. There. Welcome back to where we once were. Close to the beginning of the end. So this guy that I introduced you to in the beginning, in IRS agent Steven Berryman, has made his call to the FBI, who have put him in touch with FBI agent Jared Randall, who was the FBI agent who initially headed the fraud case against some of the FIFA bigwigs, like Jack Warner, in 2011. You know, the one that Steve Berryman and the rest of the free world found out about through his Google search? After he excitedly gave a presentation to Randall and some of his higher-ups in the FBI about the intricacies of the American tax law, and the history of and possibility of corruption in football specifically, something which he often did on his downtime, because much like me, he's a little bit of a freak when it comes to knowing these things for both business and pleasure, the FBI assigns Assistant District Attorney Evan Norris of the FBI field office in New York, Amanda Hector as well, on the case. Then, once it became more obvious that this case was going to extend much further beyond what they had initially thought, District Attorney Norris brought one of his colleagues in on the case, based on the now much larger scope of this FIFA case, our now dynamic duo in Agent Steve Berryman and FBI Agent Jared Randall have decided that the way that they're going to bring down corruption in FIFA is through the General Secretary of CONCACAF and the man who was initially known as the whistleblower in that 2011 FIFA fraud case in 2011, Chuck Blazer. There are a few reasons beyond the fact that he initially inserted himself into the fray. One of those was the simple fact that Chuck was an American. He lived, mostly in the United States, when he wasn't jet-setting for FIFA. In Trump Tower in New York City. That means that he was subject to the US legal system and the US's reach when it comes to enforcing its tax law around the world. How did Berryman convince Chuck Blazer to actually help him in going after some of his bigger, more important bosses in FIFA? Well, after convincing his bigger bosses that Chuck was the U.S. federal government's way into nabbing FIFA at large, IRS agent Steve Berryman was able to secure a subpoena to look back at Chuck's tax records. That, my friends, is what the legal community calls Leverage. It was there, again according to Ken Bensinger's Red Card, that we find out that Mr. Rich Guy Chuck Blazer hasn't paid his taxes in the United States since 1996. So how does the federal government flip a witness like Chuck Blazer in such a way that they ensure he not only gives them everything they want without alerting any of his rich friends from various places around the world? Why you make him
sign a proffer letter.
Or queen for a day letter, of course. Alright, folks. This one's rough. Ken Bensinger explained this to me, so I'm going to do my very best to not only explain proffer letters to you, but also what the went down at Chuck Blazer signed all 19 of his when he worked with federal agents between 2012 and 2014. It's about to get a little complicated, kids, so strap into your seatbelts and hold on, because this ride is about to get a little crazy. How? Well, to put it simply, explaining gangs is hard, but explaining professional gangs that are trying really hard to not be gangs is even harder. Firstly, what is a proffer letter? Well, if you haven't been charged with a criminal federal offense, as I'm assuming most of my listeners at this point have not, or you're a newly minted lawyer like my friend Julia, then it's totally okay if you're lost. But here's how the folks at SKT Law, links in show notes, say about what that actually means for a defendant looking in to strike a deal with prosecutors means to the defendant in question. A proffer letter is an agreement which exists between the U.S. District's Attorney and the defendant, which states that for the time for which the letter is valid, a person who is under U.S. federal investigation, in this case, Chuck Blazer, like I said, he signed 19 for each time that he met in person with prosecutors. This person signs this agreement that states that for the time that it's valid, they will not be prosecuted for any crimes they admit to, as long as they submit to telling the entire story of other crimes which may have not been committed by them, but may be related to others in the case. That said, a proffer agreement, or queen for a day agreement, as it's sometimes referred to in legal circles, isn't quite the same as a plea deal. Each letter has its own provisions, which, as Ken Bensinger note, differ state by state. New York, where Chuck Blazer was presiding at the time, has some of the tougher proffer laws in the country. As part of his deal, Chuck not only had to tell his story and the crimes he committed, as well as the crimes he could not travel without permission, that were committed to his knowledge, he could not tell anyone that he was doing it. He had to take calls and meetings from the feds whenever he was asked. And he would do things like wear a wire whenever asked. And if Chuck lied, told half-truths, or omitted details that the prosecutors caught him in, then the deal was off, and they could go after him for all the crimes he had implicated himself in, including those of federal tax evasion he'd already been charged with. Remember, he's been charged with 22 counts. Basically, as this podcast sees it, Chuck Blazer was basically on a hardcore version of probation without seeing the inside of a jail cell yet. What does Chuck say when he tells this story? Well, you're about to find out why it is that Ken Bensinger's book has 30 chapters, but a much more abridged version, obviously. As I see it, Chuck's story is told and absorbed by his captors in three parts. Actually, offsiders, I'm gonna have to disappoint you here, but the way that I initially wrote this episode, it was actually way too long in order to be just a single episode. So, unfortunately, I'm gonna have to not give you those three perspectives for Chuck Blazer's proffers. Part intentionally or unintentionally, based on how you look at it, wrote the next episode after this one. That, in turn, also means that I now know I can tell you that we'll finish our FIFA series in far too many episodes, even to me. Absolutely. Well, we're into this pretty deep now, kids, and I am 100% committed to finishing this story to the fullest. On that note, I hope you'll join me in this new, very long journey soon, and continue on with episode 7. Well, folks, now that we're finally at the end of this episode, I'm gonna give one final shout-out to my friend Julia and her friends in law school. Congratulations on finishing, guys. I'm so proud of you, and I'm super stoked to see you guys next time. Remember, it doesn't matter if you're onside or offside, just as long as you're inside the lines. The Two Line Offside podcast is a Sound Shifter production, meaning it's produced, edited, and researched by yours truly. Or you think I went offside, you can send me an email at offside.podcast12@gmail.com. Thanks again to Alex Action of Pixabay.com for the intro and outro of this podcast. And once again, just because we're here, please don't take this podcast for any legal advice. That's not the point. And I am 100% not a lawyer. If you want legal advice, go get your own lawyer. Hope to see you next time, guys.